Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 8th of June, 2022, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. Here to discuss current topics of interest to the UK construction industry. At least we hope they're going to be of interest, don't we, Phil?
Indeed. We've got a couple of weeks catching up to do. We had the long weekend, yep. Jubilee celebrations and all of that. So we'll be looking back to before then as well for a couple of items which came out in the news then.
Yeah.
And we'll have a chew over them and see what catches our eye.
Well, I think that the one that the topic which caught my eye, I mean, I don't think it's going to really set the construction industry alight, but it's a topic that we return to time and time again on this podcast, which is the question of net zero carbon emissions, carbon offsetting, all that sort of stuff.
Specifically offsetting.
Offsetting,
I mean,
we
have not too much problem with the whole push for net carbon. We quite like to save the planet.
Oh, sure.
It's just that you and I keep ranting about the bogusness of offsetting.
Yeah.
It's probably better to offset than not to offset, but it would be better to be really net carbon than net zero carbon, rather, than just to pretend you are by chucking a few quid somewhere.
Yeah, well, that's true. And the reason we're bringing this up again, of course, is that, you know, we talk about somebody saying, oh, we're net carbon. I think Euston Station is supposed to be zero carbon, isn't it? Because they've planted a few trees out in Malaysia or something like that. But somebody's gone one better than all that. Go on, Phil, you ran the story, so tell us what happened.
This is Beard Construction, mm-hmm. South of England regional contractor. I've got a lot of time for Beard Construction, and I think this is a fabulous way of simply taking the Michael about out of the whole offsetting business. Instead of paying some third party agency to organise some tree planting in far off lands, they've cut out the middleman and they've just gone and bought themselves a forest,
yeah.
Bought themselves a wood.
Yeah.
And I just think, That's the way to do it. Yep, we emit no pollution whatsoever because we own a wood.
Yeah.
And you think, right, done. and if people don't suddenly realise what a nonsense that makes of offsetting, then there's no hope for the world, frankly.
No.
So well done, Beard, for driving a coach and horses through the entire nonsense of it.
Well, I'm absolutely with you on that, although I have to confess I didn't detect a note of irony or sort of nudge, wink, wink in the report that Beard put out about that. It struck me that they were being perfectly serious about the whole business and that they really did believe that by buying, I think it's 180 acres of woodland somewhere near Bristol, they really are a net zero business now. I mean, clearly they're not. I mean, the wood was happily, you know, absorbing carbon, you know, on its own for quite some time under previous ownership. And just the fact that the ownership has now transferred to Beard Construction does not mean that they can now wipe out their planet-killing carbon emissions, because clearly they can't. They've just got a wood, which is very nice. I imagine it's a very nice piece of woodland. Are they going to use it for amenity purposes? It's going to be where they can send their stressed-out staff members to go and commune with nature and
if they allow the local scout troop or school groups or whatever to go camping in it,
yeah.
Social value.
Yeah, yeah.
Another box ticked. I mean, it's fabulous. You say that you don't think the press release reads very earnestly that they actually believe that they're reducing their carbon footprint.
Well, I think if they were taking the Michael, they were being very, very subtle about it. Put it that way.
I credit them with enormous intelligence, and I think they're being exceptionally dry in the finest tradition of English humour.
Good.
And so I think they know exactly what's going on here.
Good. Well, yes, I certainly hope they do, because I think that would be a very welcome commentary on the, as you say, the nonsense of carbon offsetting. Maybe other companies will buy woods and save the planet that way, because why not, you know? I'm assuming that they haven't bought it in order to redevelop it for something, which would be
This is the beauty of it, you see, is because when eventually they are properly a net zero company, when they are only driving, you know, electric diggers and building with utterly zero carbon materials,
yeah,
and they're properly zero carbon and they don't need this wood anymore,
they can cut it down.
They can develop it. Put up a theme park, roller coasters, all sorts of things, which has got even more social value.
Indeed.
All the jobs they're creating and putting up a theme park in this woodlands. Should say where it is, by the way. It's in the Mendip Hills.
Very nice.
Warrington Warren. It's got a couple of pictures of it on our website, and it does look rather beautiful.
Mm. Yeah, maybe they've hit on something there, Phil.
180 acres. I think they have.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice indeed. Well, congratulations to Beard. They've clearly done something interesting. Whether or not they think it's interesting the same way that you think it's interesting, I don't know.
They've seen the future.
They've seen the future. They certainly have.
And got there first. On the subject of nonsense, should we move on to our next topic?
Go on then. Well, this has nothing to do with the future. This is about the past, about reinventing the past, isn't it?
Well, this is a story which on the Construction Index have not been reporting on because it doesn't directly affect the construction industry, but indirectly, I'm sure it's of enormous interest, which is a consultation paper that the government published on the, it's actually called Choice on Units of Measurement, Markings and Sales. This is all to do with shopkeepers and what do they call the metric martyrs, shopkeepers who sold a pound of bananas and got prosecuted for it. And the government say one of the great things about Brexit is that we can now go back to pounds and ounces.
Yeah.
And the government's consulting what's views on how this might impact on people. What wonderful new opportunities will emerge if we can go back to pounds and ounces. It doesn't actually mention pecks and bushels in this. Pecks and bushels have been outlawed in this country since 1968, I discovered doing
some of that kind of work. Oh, really? What about chains? Chains, don't we use chains in the construction industry?
Only for tying things down.
Okay.
Pecks and bushels were outlawed long before we joined the EU or the European, the common market, I should say, as it was when we joined it in 74. So we can't blame Brussels for banning pecks and bushels. That was, who's Prime Minister in 68? Harold Wilson, I think.
I don't know. Yeah, possibly.
I think it's Harold Wilson banned the peck and banned the bushel. Can't imagine Boris Johnson banning pecks. I think he rather likes those and rather more too, I think.
Yes, indeed. But when this was announced, because I think they actually timed the announcement to coincide with the Platinum Jubilee. At least, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the impression I got. And I thought it was just a gimmick. I thought that the idea was that we're going to reintroduce pounds, shillings and ounces just for the bank holiday weekend so that people can go out and buy their beer in glasses with little crowns etched into them and go back to 1952 and the coronation year and have a really lovely, nostalgic sort of trip back in time. But actually, turns out that this was deadly serious. They really are thinking of doing this, aren't they?
Yep, this is how much they are struggling to find benefits of Brexit, it seems to me. And they actually say in the foreword of this consultation document, the government's commitment to review the current law on units of measurement was announced as part of its plans to capitalise on the benefits of Brexit. And I went and clicked on the... Back in January, they put out a document on the benefits of Brexit, listing all sorts of wonderful things. And it says, one of the benefits of Brexit is that we'll be able to use modern methods of construction.
Oh, great.
And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, is that connected to that? And I don't get it. I'm sure that all sorts of benefits of Brexit.
Yeah.
Like the ability to stand in queues and things, which we like doing.
And talk about the weather.
But, of course, in the construction industry, I mean, you mentioned chains and I mentioned pecks and bushels.
Yeah.
But we are still remarkably, or particularly the property industry, I should say, is remarkably imperial in its measurements. I mean, still,
yes,
it's all square footage.
That's right.
And acres. Most press releases we receive talking about developments, talks about the square footage and the and so on. And hardly ever about hectares and square metres.
No, that's true.
I need to go through my intro and find out which are the proper, fully metric companies who only talk about square metres and hectares in their publicity.
Yeah.
and who are the staunch imperialists?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, my daughter is a property surveyor, so she's had to get used to square feet, but it doesn't seem to have caused her any problems. My youngest daughter, who's still at university, I was reading about this actually over the weekend, and I read somebody's comment on a news website saying, well, you know, we're reintroducing things like, you know, sort of pounds and ounces for, I don't know, groceries, I suppose. And he's saying, you know, how many people under the age of 40 know how many ounces there are in a pound? And my daughter, Florence, actually happened to be there in the room as I read this. So I said, Flo, how many, do you know how many ounces there are in a pound? And she sort of furrowed her brow and she said, what's an ounce? So I think that really sort of is a fairly conclusive illustration of how difficult this is going to be to sell to people of a younger generation.
Well, even though I'm old enough to have grown up with all of that stuff and you know, learned it in junior school and so on, I still have to struggle with it. I think, I know it's either 16 or 14. Hang on. No, 14 is pounds in a stone.
Yes, that's right.
Therefore, 16 is whatever.
Ounces in a pound,
Ounces in a pound. I don't know how many pecks there are in a bushel. I've got
no
idea.
Neither do
that.
I. Actually, I've got a confession to make, because I only found this letter, unearthed this letter in my parents' papers when I cleared out their house when they moved a few years ago. Apparently, in I think it must have been 1970, I, as a primary school pupil, wrote to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who I think was Anthony Barber back then. And I don't remember doing this, but I've got the letter that came back from the Treasury.
Anthony Barber, I'm going to say 1971.
Okay, yeah, it was about decimalisation. Remember, of the currency, it used to be pounds, shillings and pence. And apparently, and I was ashamed to read this, I had written to the Chancellor of the Exchequer complaining about his plans to decimalise the currency. I think the reason was that I'd only just got my head around how many pennies were in a shilling and how many shillings were in a pound. And here he was planning on changing it all, so it's going to make life even more difficult for me. So I was certainly very resistant to the idea back then. I wouldn't like to go back to pounds, shillings and pence now, of course. It just doesn't make sense. But I did recently see an argument which explained, because, of course, you'll be conscious, as I'm sure a lot of our listeners are, that in the United States, they are far more comfortable using imperial measurements than we are. And they still use, you know, if you look on a cookery website or something like that, everything's in cups and pounds and ounces and that kind of thing. And they even measure weights. You know, you talk about a crane's lifting capacity, it'll often be in pounds, thousands of pounds, which means nothing to me. I can understand a metric ton, but not, you know, thousands of pounds. But the reason, sorry, you were going to say something?
I was just going to interrupt on the point of tons, of course. The American TON is not the same as the British TON, the long ton and the short ton. And then there's the metric ton. So we've got 3 tons. So you do have to be very careful how you spell the word ton.
Yeah.
And if you're spelling it T-O-N, you then really should clarify which ton you're talking about, whether it's a British... Hang on, who's short and who's long? British short ton and American long ton? Is it that way around? I'm not even sure which way
I've no idea. I've no idea. Another thing is nautical miles. You know, why do we have nautical miles? Why do, when you bet on a house, bet on a horse in the Grand National, is it all in guineas?
Furlongs.
Or furlongs.
Guineas and furlongs,
you know,
yes.
I mean... Yes. But these are just traditions. But there was a professor, I think at American University professor, was explaining why America has stuck to imperial measurements. I mean, they do use metric. They're not completely...
Well, at least they've got 100 cents in a dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
317 and a half.
That's true. But apparently, I can't remember which American president it was, about the turn of the 18th, 19th century, was quite in favour of the metric system. But it was resisted because it was, of course, invented during the French Revolution. It was a revolutionary idea and was very unpopular in the new American Republic. So they had a go at it, and people didn't want to do it. And it wasn't until, I don't know, about 70 years later, in sort of last quarter of the 19th century, that this movement towards metrication sort of reemerged. And by that time, a huge change had happened in America. It had become the leading industrial nation in the world. And it had done all this using imperial measurements. So when people said, well, we've got to go to metric now, they said, oh, no, you don't. Because, you know, we've got where we are now using imperial measures and we're going to stay with it. And that's really the reason. But there are other contributory reasons. And this is even more interesting, I think, is the fact that the most imperial systems, like, you know, dividing things by 12 and 16, basically a binary system. So, you know, if you're a cook or if you work in a machine shop, it feels natural to divide things by half. So, for example, say you're making bread with a pound of flour, and you didn't want to make the amount. You wanted to divide the measure, divide it in half. It's 8 ounces. Divide that in half. It's 4 ounces. Divide that in half. It's 2, and then 1 ounce. If you were to go to the similar or the nearest sort of round figure in the metric system, which would be 500 grams, divide that by half. That's 250 grams. That's fine. Divide that by half, that's
125.
Yeah, but
that's
then
easy.
Yeah, 125.
But then it starts getting harder. Yeah. Hang on, 125 by half. That's 62 and a half. Ooh,
62 and a half, and then it's 31 and a quarter. Yeah, things get really complicated, you know. And so that also
the imperial system is really designed before the days of calculators, when people were judging things by eye.
Yes,
which is why so many of the distances are, you know, the distances, for example, is to do with the on a average size. Male, I suppose it would have been the distance from the tip of your finger to your nose when your arm is stretched out. Is that a
yard?
Old yard.
Oh right, okay. No, I didn't know that.
And they all come from these basic, sort of measurements that you can. If you're a farmer in a field with no measuring tools, as you say, or, you know, a cook in the kitchen, you can, broadly speaking, go, that's about half. That's about half it again, much more easily than you can, you know, take a tenth of something.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the decimal system clearly makes a lot of sense because, I mean, it's all very relatable and interconnected in a different sort of way. It's not relatable in an instinctive way, but it's in a numerical way. You know, you've got to divide things by 10 and you're just adjusting the scale, really. So, you know, kilometres, metres, metres, you know.
But we're a very similar age. I'm sure you're the same when you're infant school or primary school. We actually had to be taught weights and measures and how they're related to each other.
Yeah.
And even when we learnt our multiplication tables, our times tables. We learn it in a singy-songy way. 1 9 is 9, 2 9 is 9.
Yeah.
And you get to the end and it's, you know, 10 9s are 19, 11 9s are 99, 12 9s are 108, 108 inches are 9 feet or whatever.
Yeah.
Did you used to do that? You'd round off the end of the rhyme when you got to 12 times and say what that actually meant in the real world, you know, why you needed to know your times tables.
Oh, we didn't do that. But that sounds like a good idea.
I can't imagine that there's any learning particularly needed. I mean, you need to be told that this is a kilogram and it's made of a 1,000 grams and so on.
Yeah.
But it's pretty easy to grasp since everything is times, you know, 100 or times 10, times 100, whatever. Much easier than what we had to learn.
I mean, although, you know, getting back to the
kids today, they don't know they're born.
But I mean, yeah. Although I can see the appeal of imperial measurements when it comes to simplicity in the kitchen or in the machine workshop, for example, I can't see that there's any practical benefit in sort of is it allowing people to use pounds and ounces again? I mean, I think obviously in order to avoid any confusion, the metric equivalent will have to be displayed. If you're selling, like, you know, I always think. It's a long time since I used to go into the sweet shop on a Saturday morning and buy, you know, 4 ounces, a quarter pound of humbugs or whatever it used to be. But that's how I think about sweets, you know, in multiples of 4 ounces. But, you know, if you wanted to do that again, you'd still have to say that it was 100 grams, which I think is roughly equivalent to 4 ounces. But it makes no sense. Why confuse things by giving you know, two alternative weights or measures. In fact, I saw there was a tweet by Mary Beard, the historian, who said, she says it's a bit of a nostalgia war. And I think she's absolutely right there. And she later said, I hope that everyone wanting to return to imperial weights and measures can multiply 1 pound 12 ounces by 3. And I thought, oh, can I do that? And actually,
36.
Yeah, well, yeah, a pound is 16 ounces. So 1 pound 12 ounces is 28 ounces. 3 28s are 84. Yeah, 84. So that's 5 pounds 4 ounces. Not that difficult. Mind you, a pound 12 ounces is about 800 grams. And that's much easier to say, you know, 3 eighths are 24. So it's 2.4 kilograms. You know, so it is easier, I think, in that respect. Although I did do a calculation and actually 1 pound 12 ounces is 793.787 grams. So we're not talking about direct equivalence here.
But it's all, I mean, it's all bogey. It's not, I don't think anyone's really saying we should move back to the, I don't think even Boris Johnson is saying we should move back to pounds and ounces because it makes much more sense or it's more British or it's more patriotic than,
no,
than, you know, French metric systems. It's more a question of freedom. And I'm all for that. If you're a shopkeeper and you want to live in the 18th century, you know, why cannot you sell your bananas by the pound?
Yeah.
Why should the metric martyrs be persecuted for selling a banana by the pound? But that's not why that Sunderland greengrocer was prosecuted in the first place. He was not prosecuted for selling bananas by the pound. He was prosecuted for not having a weighing scale that complied with trading standards.
You better tell us who this Sunderland greengrocer was.
I don't even know his name. Shall I Google
him? Well, no, you don't have to do that. But I mean, I didn't know that there was a Sunderland greengrocer wrapped up in all this.
I think he's even mentioned in this paper.
Oh, really?
No, I'm lying. It must have been in a newspaper report I was looking at.
Was this recently then?
No. This was. They do talk about the metric martyrs,
okay,
in the government document. The metric martyrs on whether street traders could sell loose fruit and vegetables in imperial measures was a totemic case in the debates on the supremacy of EU law. So this must have been at least 10 or maybe even 20 years ago.
Oh, right.
It was a while ago, but it became rather like when Boris Johnson was the Brussels correspondent of the Daily Telegraph going back 30 years ago, I guess. He would revel in, I think his father was an MEP at the time, so he had good sources, would revel in writing stories about how Brussels was banning straight bananas.
That's right.
Setting a specification for the bend of a banana. Forgetting the fact that I think the European Commission for Agriculture at the time was probably a guy called Plum, who was British. I may be wrong about the timing of that, but certainly, you know, Brussels wasn't a foreign entity. It was as much British as it was anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But they did. Brussels got down to writing specifications for what could and couldn't be sold as acceptable,
yeah,
and so on. And so the whole, you know, bendiness of a banana nonsense became a big thing. And this gave a lot of oxygen to the fire of nanny statism and Brussels interfering in Britain and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And it was taken to be that this greengrocer was a victim of Brussels, because Brussels said he couldn't sell his bananas loose by the pound. It wasn't Brussels, it was British law, and there have been British laws about what you can and, you know, what trading standards effectively.
I thought bananas should be sold by the inch.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. as the crow flies, or the as you go around it, circumference or diameter?
No, length, I imagine.
Yeah, but you mean straight length or tip to tip?
Oh no! You around the curve. I mean, you know, you couldn't take a shortcut from one point to the next. So yeah, it'd have to be. I mean, you know, if I'm choosing a bunch of bananas, if they're short bananas, I'm getting less banana for my money. So I want longer ones.
No. You're forgetting about girth. Girth matters as much as length, David. You know that.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. Okay, yeah. Well, let's get back to weights and measures, shall we?
Anyway, the point being, it's all about the it wasn't about selling by the pound. It was about not having the right weighing scales. And, of course, having the shopkeepers having to have compliant weighing scales is hugely important to consumers, consumer protection.
Of course.
So I don't give a fig what my shopkeeper sells, what unit they sell their goods in, as long as I'm getting what I pay for and not diddling me with dodgy scales.
Well, that's what standards are all about, I suppose, you know, making sure that you're getting what you're paying for.
Exactly that. But I have to say that if for example, Tesco said, we're a proper British company, we're going to go back to selling everything by pounds and ounces, and Lidl and Aldi said, well, we're sticking with kilos and grams.
Yeah.
I think I'd be inclined to shop at Lidl and Aldi, because it just, personally, I think a lot of people find it a bit easier to know
yes,
a sense
of
what they're getting.
Yeah. I mean, I, as you say, if this is one of the wins from Brexit, it's a pretty feeble win, because I'm not sure this is you're going to have the entire nation, you know, heaving a sigh of relief, or we can go back to pounds and ounces again. That's simply not going to happen. It's not a benefit at all. I can't see why they're doing it.
It's not a benefit. It's totemic. It's the freedom of choice.
It is.
Freedom of choice is a benefit.
Yeah. But I mean,
but it's got nothing to do with Brexit.
There was a chap I read here, the technology minister, Chris Philp, who I'd never heard of before. Anyway, he's a technology minister. He's in the government. He apparently told Sky News that the plan would allow, quote, a bit of our national culture and heritage back onto the shop shelf. And I think that is really what it's all about. It's just it's just window dressing. It's nonsense, actually. Talking about standards.
I was just about to say the same thing.
Certain
we've got a script in front of us.
We have indeed.
We're working towards it very well.
So, standards, not what they should be. We're talking about, there are standards, of course, for just about every product you can buy. And our old friends, the Ladder Association, who we have mentioned before on the podcast, they have had a look into the market for, or rather the range of products, of telescopic ladders. All ladders must comply with British standards, BSEN 131 Part 6, 2019 to be precise. And they commissioned a test research centre somewhere in Cambridgeshire, I believe, to have a...
Suffolk, I think.
Or was it Suffolk? Okay, somewhere over there in East Anglia anyway. But they commissioned them to have a look at the range of telescopic ladders available on the UK market, because obviously they felt that they weren't up to standard. And indeed, they found that they weren't. I think it was 80% of them failed, or they didn't conform to the standard. And when I first read about this, and I thought of a telescopic ladder, what I thought of was what you might consider to be a traditional extendable ladder, so like a two-part or even three-part ladder, which extends upwards. And I thought, well, they've been with us for a long time, and surely they're mostly reliable. And in fact, when I looked into it, it wasn't extendable ladders. It was literally telescopic ladders, which are where the stiles, you know, the side bits of the ladder, literally are like telescopes. They are lots of sections, one section per rung, in fact, telescoping down into a very compact thing which you can carry around. And I've always felt that those things look dodgy. So I'm not at all surprised to find out the Ladder Association has confirmed that suspicion.
I suspect they're great as sort of a loft ladder.
Yeah.
Because you're not climbing very much. You know, get into loft is, you've only got to go about three rungs, and then you can hang on to your loft.
That's
edge.
Right, yeah.
But it's. I think it's when they're used in outdoor applications, where you're going up to the second story of your house to, you know, clean the windows or paint the gutters or clean the gutters or whatever. Yeah, then they become, if you're, the weight goes on, obviously, physics, longer weight in the middle of a longer lever is more pressure. And then they buckle.
Yeah.
Invariably, it seems. It's not surprising. Well, one, it's not surprising that everyone's been buying these things from, you know, catalogues and whatever, because they look great. They take up so much space. You don't have to have, a garage with a ceiling hook, roof hook, ceiling hooks or whatever that you can hang the ladder on. They tuck away. Light and easy to carry, but because they're light, they're rubbish.
Yeah, well,
eight out of 10 of them fail.
I think they are essentially a flawed product, actually. Because I think probably if you're talking about a fairly short one, say 2 meters or something like that, for a loft, for example,
a loft ladder, absolutely. Yeah,
then maybe they're okay. But there are some which are sort of 6 meters or more, you know, in length. And I think the basic flaw is that you've got an extendable section, a separate section per rung. So you've got loads and loads of sections. Maybe in a 6 meter ladder, you might have 12 sections. And each one telescopes within the other. So
20 foot, David, 20 foot.
20 foot. Are we going imperial again now? six meters is about 20 foot. You're right. 6 meters. Yeah. But what you've got is at the base, they're quite thick, so there might be sort of 70 millimetres, what's that, 3 inches in diameter at the base, going up to only about, I don't know, 30 millimetres at the top, inch and a half, I don't know. So they taper quite severely as they go up. So you've got this literally a sort of... A gradient. I suppose you could plot it as a curve of how flexible they are and how strong they are, and that flexibility increases and the strength decreases rapidly as you go up the ladder. And in fact, the piece that you posted on the website, which you can go and see, has
the video.
There's a great video showing the test being carried out. Very revealing, showing how these things literally buckle. When they're put under pressure, and they're testing them in laboratory conditions. The standards do prescribe how many kilograms of weight must be capable of supporting, and for a period of time as well. And so they test them against these standards, and you can see these things, they just crumple, which is quite alarming. And the other thing about them being telescopic is that, you know, obviously each section slides into the section below it. And I don't know what sort of mechanism they use to anchor each one, but you've got, so for each rung, you've got a clip or a catch or something like that to actually stop it from telescoping down into the section below. So you've got all those little catches which have to function flawlessly. So you're introducing a level of complexity which a traditional ladder wouldn't have for a start. I just think they're best avoided, quite honestly. I wouldn't go up one, certainly not a 6 meter one. You wouldn't get, actually, I probably wouldn't go up a normal ladder that high. I don't like heights. But
having said that, we've all done it. I used to have a inherited when I bought the house in the garage, a wooden ladder, yeah. And you could tell by looking at it that it was a bit dodgy. But until I went out and bought myself a decent aluminium one, mm-hmm. or aluminium one, I would use it gingerly.
Yeah.
Make sure there are about 8 people holding a blanket beneath me as I tentatively climbed up it. But if you need to, you know, get the cat out of the tree and that's the only thing available.
Yeah.
We do it. We all use tools that we know we shouldn't because it's the best available.
We've mentioned this before, at least I know I have on the podcast, about people's concern for their own safety not being quite as keen as it is for other people's. You know, you think, oh, it's me, I'll take the risk, you know. Whereas, yeah. I mean, I if I see my wife getting into the car wearing a pair of flip-flops, I'll have a wobbly and have a real go at her and say, go and put some proper shoes on.
And then you'll go and drive barefoot.
Yeah, not quite, or I might drive in wellies or something like that, which is probably just as bad. Yeah, so we tend to take more risks with our own health and safety than we would with other people's, I think. And so, yeah, there's a tendency to, if you've got a worm-eaten ladder in your shed, and I've got some step ladders, which I have mended several times, they're wooden step ladders, because they keep breaking. But instead of throwing them away and getting a good modern set of aluminium ones, I get out a hammer and chisel and a saw and mend them myself. So anyway, yeah.
I got a broom like that. It's 80 years old.
yeah, we've heard that one many times. Well, anyway, so telescopic ladders, they're not up to it, basically. That's the bottom line as far as I can tell. So what's next?
Well, we're on a theme of all things great and British and traditional. And what could be more great and British and traditional than Stonehenge?
Oh, yes. Yes, everybody's favourite Neolithic monument.
I only know two, that and Avebury. Are there any others? Hadrian's Wall isn't Neolithic at all.
No, I don't know. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, it's World Heritage Site. World Heritage Site.
We've talked about Stonehenge. Obviously, we're talking about the A303 improvement works.
Yeah.
Do you make a making it into a dual carriageway as it goes past the Stonehenge World Heritage Site in Wiltshire, just north of Salisbury. We've talked about this project before, hugely controversial, not yet got planning permission, may not get planning permission. The Transport Secretary, I think he gave a development consent order, signed it off against the planning inspector's advice, and then that was thrown out on people opposed to the scheme, submitted a legal challenge, which was upheld. So now it's all kind of up in the air as to whether it's going to happen or not.
Yeah.
However, the news this week, last week, is that the contract hasn't been awarded, but the selected contractor has been named. Contracting team.
Yeah.
That if it does go ahead, it will be built by a joint venture called Moore, M-O-R-E, which comprises the Spanish company, FCC, the Italian company, WeBuild, who others may know as Cellini Impregilo. I think there's another. I can't remember. Impregilo merged with someone, I think.
Yes. Anyway,
yeah, WeBuild is WeBuild, Italian company.
Yeah.
And BMO Tunneling, who I think are Austrian, I believe.
Yes.
So yeah. That's the joint venture that will be building this great British infrastructure project.
Yeah. But as you say, it's still far from a done deal, isn't it? Because it hasn't got the planning permission yet. And there's still a lot of resistance to it. I've always struggled to understand why people object to this project, because I thought the idea of building a tunnel underneath Salisbury Plain as it goes past Stonehenge could only be beneficial, because of course the A303 is a very busy and congested road, particularly on that stretch of it. And so you've got all this traffic rumbling past this wonderful Neolithic monument in the middle of Salisbury
Slowing
Plain.
Down to look at it.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, well, you know, if you can put all this traffic in a tunnel so that you can't see it from the stones, that'd be great. I think, from what I understand, the main objection is that the tunnel actually isn't long enough. Because, of course, we talk about Stonehenge as if it's, you know, just an area about the size of a cricket pitch. But, of course, it's in the middle of a huge heritage site, which extends for several square miles, I assume. But, I mean, it's certainly bigger than just Stonehenge. And the tunnel only... I think the tunnel's 3.2 kilometres long. I think 3.2 is right. But the heritage site around Stonehenge is about 5 kilometres across. So this new dual carriageway, which they're going to build and which will go through the tunnel, will, of course, travel over some of the heritage site as well. So I think a lot of people are saying, if you're going to do the tunnel, it has to be 5 kilometres long so that you remove it entirely from the World Heritage Site. But I read something very interesting recently. I think he was a professor at Oxford University, but I can't remember professor of what. Archaeology, maybe, or even architecture. But he said, you shouldn't move the A303. The A303 is part of our heritage. And I thought it was a very
interesting... You should move Stonehenge. No. You should move Stonehenge instead.
Well, no, he's clearly not arguing that. But I mean, what he's...
Somewhere easier for Londoners to get to. Watford, maybe.
Well, the thing is, and if I'm going to sort of paraphrase his argument as well as I can, it is that the A303 itself is part of our heritage, and this is quite consistent with the whole idea of heritage buildings, for example, and indeed you can apply the same thing to things like art restoration, that you don't want to peel things right back and try and preserve them or convert them into something which is what they were like when they were pristine and brand new, because our heritage is an accumulation of things over the decades and the centuries, and that the A303 itself is part of that, because it was built as a main highway between London and Bath, I believe, back in the 18th century. When Bath was obviously a very popular...
No, the A4. The A4 is the old Bath Road.
Is it? Oh, right. Okay, fine. Yeah. Okay.
But it must be to Southampton or to the ports. I mean, it definitely goes southwest rather than west as the A303.
Yeah, right? That's true. Yes. Yeah, maybe not Bath. No, it's quite a long way south of Bath. You're quite right. But anyway, this argument, as I told you, I wouldn't be able to paraphrase it accurately. But his argument was that the A303 has always been there. And the public, he calculated the number of people who can see Stonehenge every day as they go past it on the A303. We all know that because they're rubbernecking. But if you took away the A303, the number of people who actually could see Stonehenge would be massively reduced. Because if you wanted to see it, you'd either have to get out and walk all the way from Amesbury, or you'd have to, you know, go and actually visit the site, drive into the car park and the visitor centre and all the rest of it. So he says it's depriving ordinary people and visitors of the right to actually view the stones. So I don't know about that argument. But
I find that an interesting argument. On your latter point, particularly, that fewer people will see it, which is a shame. But on the other hand, something does need to be done about the traffic,
yes.
I think. I don't think you should widen or double deck the existing alignment of it and put more traffic that close to the stones, even if future traffic will be less emitting of noxious fumes because we'll be battery powered or whatever, hydrogen powered. I also like the argument that built infrastructure is inherently of value as a piece of heritage, as a piece, as much as the Leonardo painting, and we should preserve it and keep it forever. I like the idea. I don't entirely hold with it. I mean, that was the argument, part of the argument about, actually it wasn't really, but it goes in line with the argument why we shouldn't be building HS2, we should be improving the railway lines that we've got.
Yeah.
But there does come a point where infrastructure is no longer fit for purpose and you can't just improve. You do have to start again.
Yeah.
Exhibit A, my lord, would be the super sewer, the Thames Tideway sewer in London. I mean, what Basil Jet built in Victorian times, absolutely fabulous for the Victorian era and for many years later. But for 2020 and 2050, it is not enough. And you can't just add on to what Basil Jet did. We need more infrastructure to go along with it. And there's another argument going on at the moment about, is it the Marks & Spencer's department store in Oxford Street? One of the big old department stores, that they want to knock it down and build something better. And people are going, oh, no, you can't knock that down. It's a perfect example of whatever it is, 1930s, 1950s, heritage architecture. And there are some monstrosities of buildings that are listed that which can't knock down because it, you know, it represents some particular awful period of awful materials. Best example of spalled concrete we can find. You know, keep it there and crittle windows or whatever. But of course, the other thing in all of this is that demolition and rebuild is much more carbon intensive, and it goes against the whole net zero thing that refurb is more environmentally friendly or less destructive, I should say.
No, you're right. I mean, clearly, I mean, we're almost getting back to the discussion about imperial measurements now, that there are parts of our heritage which we value and want to preserve, but we can't do that. We can't, you know, sort of seal the past in aspic and then completely refuse to change, because of course we have to continue. Life goes on. Our population is increasing. We have to accommodate that. So all these things, I think it's you have to make a value judgment, and you have to decide, you know, is this a specific example or an irreplaceable example of, I don't know, a certain architectural style or style period that should be kept as an example? And if that's the case, does it mean that we can actually dispose of all the other examples because we've got the best one? Each structure or artifact has to be assessed on its own merits. The argument in favour of keeping the A303, I think, is an interesting one. I think maybe his solution, and I can't remember if it was proposed by him or somebody else, was that the existing A303 be preserved as a one-way carriageway, and that you built a ring road, I don't know, up through the army camp north or something like that, so that the westbound traffic would go along one road and the eastbound along another, which might get around the problem. But I think it was quite an interesting idea that by actually trying to expunge and erase the A303, we weren't doing ourselves any favours from the heritage point of view. So another lively topic for discussion there.
Right, I think we're probably overstaying our welcome, aren't we, nearly, David?
We probably are. Yes, indeed.
Final mention I wanted to give, in case anyone missed it, was do you remember, was it last time we spoke or last month? We talked about VP, Vibroplant, put up for sale by its majority owner, Jeremy Pilkington. And I speculated rashly that I thought Altrad was going to come in and buy.
That's right, I put my
money on if I could get decent odds. And no sooner had I said that than within days it emerged that Altrad had bought Doosan Babcock, which is a 250 million odd turnover business, which does a lot of work for the in the Sellafield and for the Atomic Energy Authority. Yeah, yeah. And it probably overlaps, but Altrad will know it and will have worked alongside it at places like Sellafield, because Altrad has got its industrial scaffolding business and CAPE and Actava.
Yes, yes, of course.
B-Rate for NSG. IMD Quickform recently, which is, I don't think it's particularly got any overlap with Doosan Babcock. And it made me think, now, if Altrad is buying that 250 million turnover company, does that mean it's less likely now to go out and buy VP, as I thought it might, which is a similar sort of large bite for it?
Yeah.
Or does it show, oh, it's got an appetite for this sort of acquisition, it makes it more likely? I don't know. I actually think it possibly makes it less likely. I think it takes time to bed in these acquisitions. So I've gone slightly cooler on my Altrad to buy VP notion, which I initially had.
Well, it might still happen, I suppose. Maybe not just now, as you say. You know, it would be a fairly indigestible chunk to absorb, wouldn't it? The Doosan Babcock and VP within a few weeks of each other. So I don't know. I suppose we should still watch this space, because I think you're right that the word is synergy. There's plenty of synergy between Altrad's portfolio and VP's. So, you know, maybe it might happen.
I say VP was about 250. Actually, they just announced their annual results this week, 350 million turnover, from 300. So good, a good year. And they're back in profit. They made £35.6 million profit VP for the year to end of March 2022, compared to a £2.3 million loss last year. So they're looking in good shape. But no more news yet on the sale process.
Okay. So no more predictions, or
no, keep your mouth shut.
All right, Phil.
Well, thank you, everyone, once again. But from David and myself, another episode of Reconstruction. We'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time, when it'll be nearly July by then.
Yeah, I know, unbelievable.
But thank you. I should say, if you want to get in touch, we have a dedicated email address, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Let us know what you're thinking, let us know what you're talking about, and tell us what we should be thinking. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.